Well, today, believe it or not, is our next to last message in this 31-week series. We're walking through Acts together. You know, over the past few weeks, we saw where Paul was beaten up and arrested simply for sharing the gospel, for telling people about Jesus, right? But there he is lying in a cell, beaten and bloody, and of all things, Jesus appears to him and says, basically, Paul, it's all good. Don't worry about it. I've got this. In fact, I've got a new assignment for you, and you're going to be my mouthpiece in Rome. I'm actually going to have you speak to Caesar himself. So, Paul, it's all good because I've got a plan. Well, following that then, Paul, of course, presents himself and his case before the governor at the time, Felix. Felix listens, realizes that this man isn't guilty, he's innocent, and yet keeps him in prison 2 more years. Now, following that, the next governor succeeds him, Governor Festus, and same thing. He shares his case with Festus. Festus listens and says, just as Felix did, I find no guilt. The man's innocent, and yet he keeps him in prison. But a short time later, King Agrippa came to town, as we looked at last week, and Agrippa says, well, let me hear his case. He heard his case, and he says, yeah, I think he's innocent too, right? In fact, as we said, the King James says it translated that way, that Agrippa even said, Paul, you've almost convinced me to be a Christian. Almost. You remember last week we also said this, that to be almost right with God is to be completely separated from God. You can't be partially right about Christ. You either believe who he is and who he says he is, or you have no relationship with the Father. Now, let me give a point of correction here also. After last week's message, Christy corrected me. The illustration I used about rodeo and rodeo, right? The reason I landed there was I opened the map and being quick, and I'm just proud I was looking at a map, right? But quickly looked down at that little legend there, and I went to Rodeo Road, not Rodeo Drive. So there you go. It was all my fault, right? Had nothing to do with the navigator. And that's where we really needed to get to. We closed chapter 26 last week, and you'll remember Paul, both to after he pleads his case, Agrippa finally says, listen, Paul, you could have been set free if you had not asked to appeal to Caesar. Now, what's interesting about that, what we know, is he could have been set free anyway. In fact, it would have been better and easier for them to just cut him loose. Why in the world? They're going through all this turmoil thinking, we're going to send this man to Caesar, and we don't know what to tell Caesar why he's there. Caesar, we're sending you an innocent man to try, right? We couldn't find anything wrong with him. See if you can. All right, so it would make the most sense for them to cut him loose, but they didn't. Why? Because God had a plan, and that plan was for Paul to be in Rome. Well, today we're going to look at chapter 27 and hopefully get in a little bit to chapter 28 as well this morning. And if you read commentators, when it comes to chapters 27 and 28, what you're mostly going to find, and where a lot of people like to preach from, and because it's there, are leadership lessons from Paul. Because we see so many great leadership characteristics displayed in his life in these chapters. But I want to remind you, when we first started this study 30 weeks ago, I said this. A lot of people refer to it as the Acts of the Apostles or the Acts of the Disciples, but that's not the case. The book of Acts is the Acts of God, of Jesus, and ultimately the Holy Spirit through the disciples and through the believers. And so today, I want us to look at that. We're going to see this today. Sailors, storms, shipwrecks, snakes, and the sovereignty of God. Because see, here's the thing, folks. People in this world will turn against you. They will. Nature can even turn against you. Your plans can change, and even they can turn against you. But the sovereignty of God never will. See, when we come to that place as a believer, understanding that God is sovereign over all things, that he is supreme, and that he is able to do anything in our lives and through our lives, then we'll walk closer and more securely with him. And I believe that's what we see throughout the pages today. With that said, then, you can open up your app. The text is there, and yes, it's a lot. I'm going to do my best this morning. Or you can open up your Bibles. We're going to get in Acts chapter 27, verse 1. Because when it was decided that we were to sail to Italy, they handed over Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion named Julius, one of the imperial regiment. Now, let me pause there for a second. Notice right out of the gate, the pronoun we, right? Who wrote the book of Acts? Luke, that's right. So Luke is now, Luke is giving us a first-person account. He was with Paul on this journey, right? They are there together. And I'm going to kind of summarize 2 through 8 and do so by looking at a map. So there they are. They're down here, as you see on the screen, in Caesarea, right? He's gone before all the governors. He's gone before King Agrippa and everything else. Finally, they say, all right, then, go to Caesar, right? The first leg of their journey, then they make it all the way to Sidon, just a short distance. There, the text tells us that Paul is actually given some liberty for others to meet his needs, and certainly his cut man, right, his physician Luke, to help him out as well. Then they get back on the ship, and they sail. Now, their goal, remember, is go over here to Italy, right? But I want you to look at the journey they took. And because the winds were blowing against them, they had to go north all the way to the northern coast of Cyprus to sail around. They do that, and they find themselves here at this port in Myra. There in Myra, then they dock the ship they're in because their vessel is kind of a small vessel, the soldier's vessel. And they actually get on board of a very large ship, a very large vessel that was a grain vessel that was going all the way to Italy. So Paul, the centurion, and all the soldiers load up with them, and they set sail again. Now, again, their desire is to go to Italy, but because of the winds, they take an alternate route that hopefully the land masses would kind of break some of the wind for them. And their idea was to land to port here in Cnidus. But the winds were so strong, the text tells us, that the boat literally couldn't pull into dock, and it pushed them all the way around the south end of Crete until they found themselves finally harbored there in a place called Fair Havens. And that's where I'm going to pick up in verse 9. By now, much time had passed, and the voyage was already dangerous. Since the Day of Atonement was already over, Paul gave his advice and told them, "Men, I can see that this voyage is headed towards disaster and heavy loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion paid attention to the captain and the owner of the ship rather than to what Paul said. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided to set sail from there, hoping somehow to reach Phoenix. Now, not Phoenix, Arizona. All right, you see Phoenix here on Crete, right? That was where they were looking to port. A harbor on Crete facing southwest and northwest, and their desire was then to winter there. Now, let me pull this out. They've already been at sea for 2.5 months, right? To get from Caesarea to where they are, it said it was a slow process, 2.5 months just to arrive where they were. And Luke notates here that it was past the Day of Atonement. Now, on the Jewish calendar, we know then that would be the end of September or the beginning, early October, that this would have taken place. And here's what you need to understand. Ancient sailing vessels, they avoided travel altogether from mid-September all the way through mid-November. And from mid-November all the way to February, they refused to sail. They wouldn't do it. They avoided it altogether. Paul's ship, man, they're into December at this point, right? They're well into the danger period. And Paul kind of speaks up and tells the centurion, "Listen, I don't think we ought to do this," right? But instead of listening to the preacher Paul, he listens to the captain and the owner of the ship. In fact, it even says they took a little straw poll among the sailors and said, "No, I think we're going to make it one more lag. We're going to get here to Phoenix, and then everything will be fine. We'll spend the winter there." So they would spend several months, the entire winter, to allow the seas and the winds to calm down before they would set sail again. So in essence, what they said is, "Listen, Paul, we're not going to trust in you. We know you're a man of God, but in essence, hey, we're not going to trust in what God is telling you. We're going to trust in our own skills. Hey, preacher, we're the sailors. You just keep your seat, right? We're going to trust in what we can do." Let's keep reading verse 13. "When a gentle south wind sprang up, they thought they had achieved their purpose. They weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. But before long, a fierce wind called the Northeaster rushed down from the island. Since the ship was caught and unable to head into the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. After running under the shelter of a little island called Cauda, we were barely able to get control of the skiff. After hoisting it up, they used the ropes and tackle and girded the ship, fearing they would run aground on the Syrtis." Now let me stop and explain some of that for just a minute. They had the skiff, right? That's kind of the lifeboat, if you will, and it's trailing behind the large vessel. So they would have a rope tied to this lifeboat, if you will, and it would be way, way behind the boat, right? And so as these waves are coming and just pounding the boat, it says the sailors come together and they pull this rope all the way on board. pull the lifeboat, the skiff, the dinghy, if you will, up onto the deck as well. And then they take those, and it says they use the rope to gird the ship. Now, ships in those days were made out of wood, right? And they were a tongue-and-groove construction. And what would happen on a good sea, man, that would hold together nice and tight, and the wood would soak in some of that water and get tighter and strong, right? But on stormy seas, when the boat is getting pounded and the ocean itself is moving and pulling the boards in different directions, what can happen is they can actually open up the tongue and groove and allow water into the hull of the boat and can even sink the ship. So what they would do is they would take these ropes. They pull this dinghy in, right? Take the long rope off this, and they would go to the front or the bow of the boat and drop the rope. And then they would allow it to go about midways around the boat, and then they would tie it up. Literally, they were tying a rope around the boat in order to hold it together. That's exactly what girding the ship meant. And the reason is they were afraid of this area right here that is known as the Syrtis. Right? In this area, notice you've got a lot of different seas all coming together, different water temperatures, different directions of wind all coming this place. And this was kind of known as the graveyard of the sea in that day, right? This was their Bermuda Triangle, if you will. Because what it was also known for, because of all these different currents under the ocean, it would develop large sandbars way out here in the ocean. And so the ships were afraid, and then certainly this one, that they would hit one of those sandbars. Let's keep reading. Then they lowered the drift anchor, and in this way they were driven along. Because they were being severely battered by the storm, they began to jettison the cargo the very next day. Now it says this, that they also took out a drift anchor. It means they went to the back or the stern of the boat, right? And they dropped an anchor out to let it hit the bottom of the sea and kind of drag it along. The winds and the storm was pushing them, and the current was pushing them so fast that they drug an anchor just to slow the ship and try to straighten it out. It says not only did they do it, they began to jettison the cargo. Now, what does jettison mean? How many of you guys have ever seen a barge in the Tennessee River? Right? You ever seen a barge? Sure, right? If you've ever seen an empty barge, you'll know that it sits way up above the water, but really high. But as they're filled up with cargo, what happens? They lower in the water, don't they? And in fact, the lower they are, the more solid and secure they are. But the weight of the cargo pushes the boat down into the water. Now, generally, that's good because it helps stabilize a boat. But when you're in a sea and the waves are literally crashing over the top of the boat, do you want your boat lower or higher in the water? You want it higher, don't you? You want it to get up. So they began to literally throw cargo out, throw some of the heavy things out of the boat so it would lift it up in the water so the waves wouldn't crash over the top. Verse 19, on the third day, it says they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. For many days, neither sun nor stars appeared, and the severe storm kept raging. Finally, all hope was fading away that we would be saved. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul then stood up among them and said, "You men should have followed my advice not to sail from Crete and sustain this damage and loss." Let me stop there for a second, by the way. Acts chapter 27, verse 21. This is my wife's life verse. You should have listened to me, right? That's not true. And I don't even know if I'll say that in the next service because she's here, but... But that is what Paul's saying. He said, "Hey, you should have listened to me," right? Verse 22. "Now I urge you to take courage because there will be no loss of any of your lives, but only the ship. For last night an angel of God that I belong to and serve stood by me and said, 'Don't be afraid, Paul. It is necessary for you to appear before Caesar. And indeed, God has graciously given you all those who are sailing with you. So take courage, men. Because I believe God, that it will be just the way it was told to me. But we have to run aground on some island." Now, Paul says here, "Hey, listen, guys, don't worry. I know it looks bad. I know it feels bad. But God's got this. It's all good. God's got a plan." See, here's what the experience that Paul had. This wasn't his first rodeo, was it? I mean, to him, a shipwreck? Come on, man, right? A storm? This joker's been beaten and left for dead multiple times, arrested so many times he can't remember, right? And every time God says, "No, it's all good. You're going to go to Rome," right? You ever notice when you've been through some stuff And God's carried you through some stuff. And I mean some stuff. You know what I'm talking about? When you've been through some stuff with God, you have a different perspective on life, don't you? You really do. I'll be honest. As pastor in counseling sometimes, I have to really guard myself not to minimize what others are going through at times. You know, when I have people just sharing their heart with me and they're just, their life's coming to pieces for something that just seems minuscule, right? But to them, it's very important, and I understand that. But I'm going to tell you, when you've been through some stuff in life, you got a different perspective. And I'll be looking at them, I'll pray with them, I'll think, God, you're all right. This is going to be okay. Hey, you're going to forget about that when you get out of high school. Hey, sir, you're going to get another job. Hey, she's going to find you. You're going to be okay. See, when you've been through it, it just kind of gives you a different perspective. It's things that sometimes seem so big on earth, you know, they're really not that big or important, are they? When you've been through some stuff. Paul's been through some stuff. And he's telling these guys, hey, it's all right. God said we're going to get there. We're going to get there, right? I'm good with that. Verse 27, when the 14th night came, we were drifting in the Adriatic Sea. And about midnight, the sailors thought they were approaching land. They took soundings and found it to be 120 foot deep. A sounding, they'd have a big lead ball on the end of a rope. They'd drop it off, right? And they would either count or they would have the rope marked to know exactly how deep the water was, right? It was the early old school depth finder, if you will, for the boat, right? So taking the sounding, when they had sailed a little farther and sounded again, they found it to be 90 foot deep. Then, fearing we might run aground on the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed. Boy, and now they're praying, right? Now all of a sudden, looking for God. They prayed for daylight to come. Some sailors tried to escape from the ship. They had let down the skiff into the sea, pretending that they were going to put out the anchors from the bow. Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Then the soldiers cut the ropes holding the skiff and let it drop away. Now, let me pause there a second. Do you understand the significance of that? These men have in hand the lifeboat. I mean, this is it. You know, y'all ever been on a cruise and they make you go through that little procedure that if things go bad, get to the dinghy, right? That's your salvation. That was it for them. They had in their hands the dinghy, the lifeboat. And on Paul's remarks to the centurion, they literally cut them away. Let them drop into the ocean. Verse 33, when it was about daylight, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day that you have been waiting and going without food, having eaten nothing. Now, 2 weeks and they've eaten nothing. That's how bad this storm is. For 2 weeks, they're making this travel right here. 2 weeks in a stormy sea, not even eating. He says, verse 34, so I urge you to take some food. For this is your survival, since none of you will lose a hair from your head. After he said these things and had taken some bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all of them, and after he broke it, he began to eat. They all were encouraged and took food for themselves. In all, there were 276 of us on the ship. I love that. Paul counted every one. Now, why is that important? Because God's going to get 276 men to safety, all for the sake of Paul. Every one of them counted, every hair on their head. When they had eaten enough, it says in verse 38, they began to lighten the ship by throwing the grain overboard into the sea. Now, pause again. The grain is why the ship was traveling. Remember, they jumped on board here in Myra, but it was heading to Italy to take grain. That was a big deal. This would be one of the last ships leaving. And listen, if you were a sailor and you showed up without the grain, it could mean your life. At a minimum, it means livelihood because you would lose your means of support. Right? You'd lose your job. And yet, they began to throw everything overboard. That's how dire their situation was. Verse 39, when daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but sighted a bay with a beach. They planned to run the ship ashore if they could. And after cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea. At the same time, loosening the ropes that held the rudders, then they hoisted the foresail and the wind, and headed for the beach. But they struck a sandbar and ran the ship aground. The bow jammed fast and remained immovable, while the stern began to break up by the pounding waves. Remember that the bow is the front of the boat, the stern's the back, right? So they're heading in, man. They're cruising. We're going to make it. We're going to make it. Bam! Sandbar sticks them dead in the water. Right now, then they've got these crashing waves coming over the back, just pounding the back of the ship. Boards are starting to fly and go everywhere. Verse 42, the soldiers' plan then was to kill the prisoners so that no one could swim away and escape. Boy, there's a way to say thank you, isn't it? Appreciate it, Paul. Tell you what, bank, we're going to have to kill you now, right? How crazy. Verse 43, but the centurion kept them from carrying out their plan because he wanted to save Paul. And so he ordered those who could to swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to follow, some on planks and some on debris from the ship. The ship was busting into pieces and literally had debris floating everywhere. In this way, everyone safely reached the shore. Chapter 28, once safely ashore, we then learned that the island was called Malta. The local people showed us extraordinary kindness. They lit a fire and took us all in, and since it was raining and cold, as Paul gathered a bundle of brushwood and put it on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastens itself on his hand. When the local people saw that the snake hanging from his hand, they said to one another, "This man, no doubt, is a murderer. Even though he has escaped the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." But he shook the snake off into the fire and suffered no harm. They expected that he would begin to swell up or suddenly just drop dead. And after they waited a long time and saw nothing unusual happening to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. Now, let's jump into this. They get on shore, right? They're there safely. And all of a sudden, Paul's going for some firewood. And what happens? Bam, a snake, a viper, grabs a hold of him, bites him. Now, these people had seen this before. They lived on this little island, right? They knew what happened when this particular viper got a hold of somebody, and it didn't end good for the person. So they're waiting, and they're watching. Notice also it says that, he survived the storm, but justice is going to get him. Do you notice justice being capitalized? Do you see that? Now, they're not talking about justice as far as the judicial system. Now, they're referring to the goddess justice. So that was a goddess that they had worshipped at the time. And as they're waiting for this and realizing it's not coming to be, they realize, man, this Paul has something even greater. Now, let me say this too. Let me just pause for a second. We got a few minutes. I want you to notice, the snake came out of hiding with the fire, right? That snake would have stayed there, but when they lit the fire, the snake came out. Can I tell you something? This is a little bit of a stretch, but it's true. You get on fire for Jesus, snakes will come out. Huh? You get on fire for Jesus, you'll find some vipers. You start talking about Jesus in school, in the workplace, you'll have some naysayers. You bring it into the house, there's going to be a snake or two pop out. You get on fire for Jesus, there's always snakes that'll show up. But look what Paul did. Shook it off. That snake, that viper got a hold of him. Paul, it says, just shook it off and threw it in the fire. Can I tell you something else? Hey, don't hang on to things that'll poison you. Don't hang on to it. Paul didn't sit there. Hey, look here, right? Throw it away. Hey, if there's things in your life that are poison, things in your life that are separating you from the will of God, and you know that, throw them away. Separate yourself. Don't stay attached to them. You know, I've said repeatedly, as we go through Acts, there are passages that are descriptive. There are passages that are prescriptive, meaning this. There are some things we read, and it's describing what was taking place at that point in time in history. There are other times when it is prescribing something the early church did and something we should do today, just like going into all the world with the gospel. This is not a prescriptive verse in the text. Right? Now, I know, first of all, I want you to notice this. He didn't grab the snake. The snake grabbed him, right? And I know several years ago there were those docuseries coming out, right? Of all those old country preachers, right? In the Appalachia, it was Tennessee, Kentucky, and North Carolina, right? And if you ever go to a little church and there's a box, a small box out in the front of the stage, it ain't a church for you, I'm telling you, right? If it's in the country around here. But you've seen that, right? And these old country preachers, Adam, y'all from Cleveland out there, they got snake handlers out there, I know. But they open that box up. Now, reach down and snatch out them snakes, right? Shake it. Y'all ever seen that? And shake them around. And boy, if you've got faith, then these snakes won't bite you. Yes, they will. Snakes aren't saved, right? That's the dumbest thing that I have ever in my life encountered. Paul didn't grab that snake and say, look here, I got faith in God. No, he was grabbing firewood to warm himself. The snake grabbed him. And people take that text and they'll go to Luke 10:19, where Jesus said, look, I've given you authority to trample on snakes. Well, that's a far cry from purposely snatching one up, isn't it? Or in Mark 16, even with the Great Commission, it says, hey, you will be able to pick up snakes. Jesus was prophesying what was going to take place in the early church. Why? So that they would know that these men are saved. But let's go back to, remember when Jesus was being tempted in Mark? Hey, he was baptized by John the Baptist. He went out into the desert into the temptation, and Satan was tempting him day after day after day. And a couple of those temptations said this, that Jesus was there. I mean, he hadn't eaten for 40 days. He was hungry, right? And then Satan said, hey, Jesus, all you got to do is tell that rock to be bread, and it'll happen. And it would have. Tempted it again and said, hey, listen, took Jesus up on this high place. Said, listen, you can throw yourself down from here. Your Father in heaven, he'll send the angels. You won't bruise your heel. They'll pick you up. You remember Jesus' response? Jesus said, yeah, I know I could. I know that God would. But he said this, it is written, do not test the Lord your God. We're not to test God. When you see preachers on TV or those docuseries things doing idiotic things like that, we're not called to test God. The snake grabbed him. I got to get off that, right? It says then, keep on in verse 7 then, that later after they realize, hey, Paul is okay. He must serve some kind of God. They go and they meet someone else on the island there that takes care of them and all the men. In verse 10 then it says, so they heaped many honors on us. And when we sailed, they gave us what we needed. This island of Malta, they were there, and all the people, after they saw the man who Paul was, and I'm sure heard him sharing about a holy God. So they gave him everything they needed to make their journey then to Rome. Now, here's what I want us to understand and see. It all started here in Caesarea. Remember, Jesus met him in the cell and said, listen, Paul, you're going to go to Rome. They hadn't made it halfway there yet. It's now been 6 months. They end up, here in Malta. They end up for 6 months now at sea and wintering there before they can even leave. And he's still not in Rome. But as I was studying this week, and again, so many people say, just look to the leadership passages, but I couldn't help but to just see the sovereignty of God. And here's what came to mind for me. Little Malta. Look at it. You see Malta, I mean, man, if you can't, if I can do this well, look at that little bitty island, right? Oop, I'm going to mess it up. There you go. Little Malta, just this tiny dot on the map, smaller than anything else we see, smaller than anywhere else Paul traveled. I'm studying little Malta. I got to thinking about, God had Malta in mind that whole time. In fact, we can go back even farther, can't we? When Paul was persecuting the church, driving people out of their homes and killing them for preaching the gospel, God had little Malta in mind. When Paul was on a road to Damascus to do just that, and yet he encountered Christ and the scales fell from his eyes and he got saved, God was thinking about Malta. When Paul was on his first missionary journey, remember in Lystra, and they stoned him to death and threw his body outside the city, but God was thinking about Malta. Paul came back to life. When Paul got arrested down here in Caesarea and beaten, and surely they were going to kill him, God had Malta in mind. When they finally got on the ship and through all these stormy seas, all the while, God had little bitty Malta in mind. When the prisoners, when it was getting dire and said, hey, let's just kill, when the soldiers said, let's kill the prisoners, God had Malta in mind. Let me tell you a little bit about Malta. Malta's a tiny little island, still there today. It's slightly larger than the city of Murfreesboro, but has four times the population. There are over 500,000 inhabitants on that little island today. In fact, it's known as one of the densest populated places in the world today. And of this over 500,000, 96% today identify as a Christian. Did you hear that? This packed island, four times more populated than the city of Murfreesboro. Over 500,000 people, 96% of them identify as Christians. Let me frame that for you. In America, 65% of adults make that same claim. Little Malta, 96%. They have 14 public holidays. 7 of them are Christian. And the greatest, one of the greatest holidays they celebrate every year is on February 10th. It's St. Paul's Feast. And they celebrate the landing of Paul on the island. You know, again and again, I have to think, Paul had to think, boy, this is going to be it now. Ooh, boy, look at these. You know, this is it. It's all going to end here. But God had Malta in mind. He never told, he told Paul, I'm going to send you to Rome, and he'll get there, right? But all the while, God had Malta in mind. And in my study, here's where I think I landed. You know, wherever you are today, maybe you're in a situation or circumstance, and it seems dire. But I want you to ask the question, God, what do you have in mind? What are you going to do in this? What is your plan through this? Everything going on, God had Malta in mind. Look at Malta today. One of the most Christianized places on the planet. All because of God's plan through Paul. There's a great quote that says, smooth seas don't make skillful sailors. Ain't that the truth? Hey, every one of us, if we were on that boat, we would have been praying for one thing. What, smooth seas that whole time, wouldn't we? We would. We'd be fasting. We'd be praying. Let's just be real. Calm waters. God, that's what we want. But instead, God used a stormy sea for His glory. Instead, He used a shipwreck. Isn't it something? The vessel that carried the messenger was completely destroyed. But the vessel that carried the message was saved. Little old Malta. God had a plan. Church, visitor, church member, God's got a plan. And man, when we'll trust in the sovereignty of God and when we'll get on mission for God and do what God is calling us to do, who knows? Who knows what Malta may be lying in your life?